The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Someone asked about the language on the handout. And there's probably a few of you here who didn't get the handout. Does anybody not get the handout? Okay, handouts. Oh, no, they're two different ones. So here's one of this one for each of you, then I have another one. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to have your handout with you. But there was a clarification on the language in the description of clear comprehension of reality. And I talked about the different aspects of clear comprehension on both Sunday and Monday night, the four aspects. And the main one we're really looking at here this week, I think, is really, well, the two of purpose and suitability together this week. Miriam. Hi, Miriam. that was my main hope, that we could explore purpose and suitability together, both in particular around what is our intention, what's our aspiration, and how are our everyday activities suitable for supporting that aspiration. The clear comprehension of domain, the clear comprehension of reality. In terms of our daily life, the clear comprehension of domain is really about bringing our mindfulness into our everyday activities. The domain of our practice is just the domain of everyday life. And the word domain is a weird one. Clear comprehension of the pasture, the field, those are the actual term means something like pasture or field. And it's where we're nourished. And so when we're not aware of what's happening, we're kind of acting out of our habitual patterns, habitual tendencies, our conditioning, and that doesn't tend to be nourishing our movement towards freedom, towards happiness. And so the clear comprehension of domain is about recognizing essentially when we are in the field of awareness, field of mindfulness. Just very briefly, these. And then the fourth, the clear comprehension of reality. I think of the clear comprehension of reality as really the result of our practice. It is the opening to the understanding that happens as we practice, especially around the key three insights of impermanence, unreliability, that those two are very intimately connected, that because everything is impermanent, it's inherently unreliable as being a place where we could say, yes, this is what's going to make me happy, because this is impermanent. It will end, it will change, and so it can't ultimately make us happy. The third is the clear comprehension, the recognition, the understanding around the not-self-teaching. And the language here is a little strange. When I wrote it, I don't think I really reviewed it very well when I wrote it. The understanding of not-self, that there is no doer or experiencer behind our actions. Maybe a slightly better wording would be something like, there's no doer behind our actions, no doer behind our intentions and our actions, no one who intends, no one who does, There is doing, there is intending. These unfold as a result of causes and conditions, kind of organically. When we're mindful, when we're not mindful, the organic unfolding of those intentions tends to be our habits and patterns, the way we were conditioned. When we are mindful, the unfolding of those intentions, those actions, becomes informed by mindfulness, and there's a possibility for wisdom to support making choices in our lives. So when we're aware, we're mindful, wisdom can come in. We can, and it feels, it very much feels initially like I'm the one who's doing something. It can feel like I'm making a choice to not act on this anger. When it feels like that, I mean, one thing I kind of like to say, one pithy thing I like to say is, if it feels like you have a choice, make a skillful one. You know, so if you have that sense in mindfulness of feeling like there's a me here, and you know, it does feel like there's a me here. And so not to try to deny that or to push it away, but just to begin to recognize, okay, this is part of the investigation. What is it that feels like me? And when it does feel like there's a me here, using that, when mindfulness is present, we can use that me skillfully to support making a skillful choice. But ultimately, it's kind of just an illusion. It's a construct in our minds. This feeling, this notion of self, is a construct of our minds. It's a perception of our, kind of a way we're recognizing our experience. And the insight into not self is to essentially see through that, to see that this sense of me or mine is simply a construct of the mind. The other aspect of this is that we can begin to see, as we observe our doing, as we observe doing happening, we see that doing is simply doing itself. That can be an experience, that can be that's quite a remarkable experience that we can touch into. You know, we see the body choosing and acting and doing, and it's like, whoa, how's all this happening? It's kind of the doing itself is just unfolding. And that's a taste or a flavor of the recognition of not-self around the intentionality, around the aspect of mind that intends, that chooses, that does. There's another layer of selfing that, you know, I've seen, that I can be in that space of seeing I'm not the one doing it. You know, I can be in that space of recognizing these choices are happening. We start to observe, and this is something I'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow night. We begin to see intention happening. An intention happens before everything that we do, before we speak, before we move our bodies, even before we think, or even before there's a shift in the state of our mind. There's an intention that arises. That intention may be conscious or maybe not conscious. So there's that possibility of intention just unfolding, as I said the other night, just out of conditions, out of our conditioning, out of our habits, those intentions will arise. When we're mindful, we can begin to see this process of intention being created by conditions. A simple example, we're sitting at the computer and you know, we may be, if we're not so terribly mindful, we may be sitting at the computer and think, oh, I need to get up and get a glass of water. And and get up and go get the glass of water. And I did that. Feels like I did that. If the mindfulness is a little more clear, we may recognize that there are conditions. We've been sitting at the computer for a couple of hours. Thirst arises. That thirst arises the intention to satiate that thirst, which conditions the arising of movement, which conditions the movement. It conditions the intention to move, conditions the movement. And we can start to see that it's just like dominoes falling. You know, it's not a me here doing it. It's conditions unfolding that we go get that glass of water. So we can start to see that. And then there's another level, a kind of a subtler level of identification with self that is, you know, I can see at this point that I'm not the one doing it, but sure feels like I'm the one that's experiencing all of this. I'm sitting back here watching the body and mind do all of this, and well, who's observing that? It feels like I'm observing that. And so that's what this other section I'd said, or experiencer, and this is not clearly worded, you know, maybe it should be more clearly written, something like, there is no doer behind our intentions or actions, no one who does, no one who intends, or experiencer behind any experience. That there's no one who the body processes, the mind-body processes receive experience. The eye receives sight. There's no little being in the eye doing that. It just is the way it's built. It receives the... Likewise, our whole being experiences. And there's no one who experiences. Now, this teaching... It wasn't so much my intention to get into an exploration of this in our daily life practice. It can come up, and I did offer on the second side of this a few reflections you could explore if you're interested in working with this sense of not self. Looking particularly around identification with experience. When we feel strongly identified with something, the way to explore this teaching on not-self is not to try to experience not-self, but rather to look at what feels like me. You know, what feels like, what is that sense of me? When do I feel that sense of me? So that's a way to explore it. And sometimes in daily life we can notice that. And we can recognize, you know, sometimes it's pretty mild, you know, maybe when you're making your bed, it's not like there's a big me there making your bed, but, you know, you could kind of explore a little bit when it feels strong. When does it kind of kick in that, here I am, I have an opinion about this, or I have a need to accomplish something, you know, when does it get strong? And then begin noticing that, looking at that, observing that. We don't decide to recognize this aspect of there is no one intending or doing, there is no one experiencing. That's more a result of our practice. So it's not, it's an insight. It comes through the practice of the other aspects of clear comprehension. We engage with our purpose and our intention. I'm using the language we, but it's just hard to speak without it. Our mind and the mind and body engages with the practice of purpose and suitability. We engage in the exploration of mindfulness, and really the mindfulness, when aligned with some understanding of what the basic wisdom that helps us come to this understanding, come to these insights, is the wisdom of what actions are skillful in terms of leading us towards happiness, and what actions are unskillful. And so looking at greed, aversion, and delusion in mindfulness, noticing non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it's really that simple. We don't have to actually go looking for much other than that. You know, when greed and aversion are present, a sense of selfing is happening. So we don't have to actually find the sense of selfing in there. We can study the aversion. We can study the greed. We study the suffering. We study how we're struggling through bringing our mindfulness to our experience. That begins to reveal the deeper layers of misunderstanding around impermanence, unreliability, not self. So that probably just opened up a can of worms, but so can turn it off and we'll see what else is out here. I would like to hear some more. A question about clarifying around when wisdom is arising, there's still no doer. So how does that work, or what is that about, or is that just some universal wisdom somehow? I think it has to do with, and I talked about this, I think either this morning, yesterday, I don't remember. I talked about the organism gravitating towards well-being. Were you here to hear that part? Okay. So this will be a little review for some of you. So our mind-body process doesn't want to suffer. It's just designed that way. We have a bunch of layers of cognition that are in the service of serving this mind-body process. You know, layers of intending and perceiving and knowing and thinking, these processes that happen. And somehow those processes are kind of short-sighted. They go for the fastest way to feeling good. So get what you want. That's pretty direct. It goes towards that fastest way to feeling okay. So there's something out there we want, we try to get it. That short-sighted process is focused on the thing we want and misses the fact that the very wanting is suffering. The very experience of wanting is unpleasant. It's like our processes are willing to put up with that level of unpleasantness, partly because we're not paying attention to it. We're focused on something else. We're focused on the idea of getting that thing, which makes the you know, brings some endorphins probably into the mind and body system. So it's like it's okay to have that wanting because the endorphins are there with that fantasy of what it's going to be like when we get it. As we start to bring mindfulness to the whole flow of experience, we see the mind and body processes begin to recognize that that wanting itself is not in the direction of well-being. So I think the wisdom is in our system. It's just that that wisdom can be overlaid with short-sighted processes, short-sighted mental processes that think they understand how to get to well-being, but don't have a very deep understanding of what well-being is. I think that just getting a little bit of chocolate is good, you know? Those processes, it's like, if I get a little bit of that chocolate, yeah, that's good. And then I got to get some more something. I've got to get a relationship. I've got to get some praise. I've got to get some money. I've got to get this. It's like we're continually getting to try to make that sense of well-being happen in our system. When we bring mindfulness in, when we start to bring mindfulness into the equation, the mindfulness begins to recognize that the way we're going about it is putting us in a state of distress. And because the system doesn't want to suffer, the system itself begins to understand that way does not lie happiness. It begins to let go of those things, the wanting. It begins to let go of the wanting, the craving, the aversion. Simply by seeing it over and over again and recognizing that way lies suffering. So the wisdom, I think, is kind of embedded in our system when we take the time to, you know, when we bring this mindfulness to what's happening. Mindfulness kind of uncovers the wisdom. The mindfulness unveils the delusion of happiness lies in getting what I want. Unless what you want is mindfulness. Now that's a good point. So I don't know that I'd use. I don't know that I'd go into mind and brain.
But you do need to want to practice.
The wanting, the desire. Desire is a part of this system. Is it on? Okay. So desire is part of this system, and there's a form of desire that has a kind of neediness to it. It's not okay if I don't have that thing. And there's a form of desire that desire. There's the craving, which has contraction around it. You know, we feel the craving. Then there's desire, which can be associated either with wholesome or unwholesome intention. So the term for the hindrance of sense desire is it's not using the term for craving. It's using this neutral kind of desire. There's a kind of a neutral desire that can be associated either with skillful or unskillful intention. And so the desire for mindfulness is a kind of a skillful desire. The desire to practice is a skillful desire.
Is there a term for that neutral desire?
Chanda. Chanda is the neutral term, the Pali term for that neutral desire. Tanha is the Pali term for craving. So yes, there is, and there are examples of this. I mean, it's almost like I see our practices being kind of staged in a way that, in order to let go of some of the grosser kinds of desires, the larger, the more craving kinds of desires, in order to let go of greed and aversion, we do have to have kind of like a stepping stone. It's like we can't let go of this stepping stone. This is like the only way we know of finding happiness, right? I mean, before we start the practice, it's like, yeah, happiness comes from getting what I want and getting rid of what I don't want. And then the next stepping stone is we begin to recognize that the suffering that's happening around that, and the mindfulness is kind of the next stepping stone. We we begin to recognize that we are supported by being mindful. I mean, I think you've all had the sense of when you actually bring mindfulness to a difficult state, it's not so, it may not go away immediately, but there's a sense of space around it. And so that's kind of a stepping stone for us, and we see the benefit of the mindfulness. And so we almost have to have the next desire, the desire to apply mindfulness, in order to let go of the kind of attachment to our old way of doing things. So that's it's kind of a stepping stone to the next level. And there's, it seems like there's multiple stepping stones. I think the unfolding happens organically. When mindfulness is present, the system heads towards happiness. And it is, it feels like accomplishment in a way, but there's no one accomplishing, you know. Why do anything once, you know, it's just a natural arising that, you know, kind of the, I think what happens, why do anything when you get to that place? Because the heart responds to suffering, the heart responds to happiness, you know, that if you're in a space of open, they accept the suffering, but if you see somebody suffering, the natural response is to take action. So,
are you acting for being a doer?
No, it's a natural response. That there's a, there's spontaneous, yes, spontaneous. So there's an analogy, or not an analogy, but a story of somebody asked. This is a Zen story, I think. Somebody asked a teacher, what does it feel like to be the bodhisattva of compassion? So the bodhisattva of compassion is an awakened being that is the manifestation of compassion, acts when there is suffering, acts to alleviate suffering. And the response to that question was, it feels like plumping your pillow at night. That it's just the most natural of responses. It's not anyone doing, it's just conditions unfolding skillfully, spontaneously. Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually the question of selfing and service has come up a couple of times in this room. Actually, the and until, you know, until there's a full awakening, until there's the full understanding and dropping away of the self, I think all service is going to have some selfing in it, and so. You know, to not try to, I mean, to not do the service, but to recognize when we are serving, where's the contraction? Where's the contraction and where's the openness? So I think this whole question around self and not self really comes down to just exploring where does it feel like that action is coming from an unskillful place, and where does it feel like it's coming from a skillful place? And then it gets refined. I talked about that refinement. Initially, it's kind of, you know, it's clear that there's perhaps, you know, some aversion or something that's motivating some of this. You know, I need to fix this person. This is why I'm going to serve. But that wasn't so clear until you started looking at your mind, and then it's like, oh yeah, there's some selfing there, and it becomes more clear that's not such a wholesome place to help from, to fix somebody. And then we begin to see, okay, there's more wholesome ways of serving. And then in those wholesome, more wholesome ways of serving, we may find subtler levels of clinging that we begin to be refined as we explore. So really it's about exploring, where is there clinging, where is there contraction, where is there greed, aversion, delusion? That exploration, I think, is much more straightforward, more realistic than trying to look at selfing and not selfing. At times we can really clearly see a sense of self, but much of the time it comes just as we feel the greed, we feel the aversion, and we feel the delusion, and that's really where we can explore. Yeah. We do need the We don't want to record the relationship between spontaneity and mindfulness. I don't know that there's I could say a few words. The thing that pops into my mind to say is that the relationship between spontaneity and mindfulness, or one relationship, I wouldn't say the relationship, a relationship between spontaneity and mindfulness, is that when we are, it's kind of a funny thing. I mean, the being is pretty spontaneous no matter what. When we are not mindful, there's a kind of a spontaneous unfolding of our conditioning, but we feel like it doesn't feel very, it doesn't have that feeling of spontaneous. So there's a difference between the feeling of spontaneous and the actuality of spontaneous. You know, so there is, you know, it's like there is this unfolding of our conditioning when, it just unfolds. When mindfulness is present, sometimes initially it can feel like spontaneity goes down. You know, it's like, needing to think, needing to observe, needing to stop. You know, here's the spontaneous arising of, the habitual arising of anger, and the spontaneous thing would be, yelling and screaming. And so it feels initially like mindfulness kind of puts the kibosh on spontaneity. And so there's a period of time where it feels like, what happened to my spontaneity? As the mind begins to learn, it's kind of that gradual releasing of the defilements. As the mind begins to learn that those, that kind of habitual movement into that conditioning leads to suffering, it begins to let go, it begins to spontaneously let go of that. And then we start to move into a place where there's much more of a spontaneous unfolding of beauty, of skillfulness. Love spontaneously arises, compassion spontaneously arises, and we're aware of that. So there's kind of a shifting point in practice where it doesn't feel like the mindfulness is kind of in the way or stopping spontaneity. It feels like it begins to reveal a wholesome spontaneity, not the spontaneity of our habits, but the spontaneity of wisdom. Okay.
Thank you. I'll record. So, interesting investigation. Let's see if I can take the content out. Having conversation, back and forth, certain things said, back and forth, heard, notice contraction, but at a very low level. But speaking from a area of really not contraction, of openness and communication between the other person. But noticing, oh, something was said and registered and there's contraction. And investigating that.
Was it something you said that no. registered contraction or something you heard?
Something I heard.
Okay.
And so, let's see. On investigating that, and so the context of what was said, and the words that were said, looking at it, since a contraction, it was pointing to. I have these models, so step back a second. When I find myself in an adverse state, unhappy, grumpy, bored, etc. You know, it doesn't have to be much, just happy, unhappy, and there's, you know, a pendulum. The unhappiness part is, it's usually pointing to an aspect of me that isn't getting what it wants. Just simple as that. And that aspect can be, or that entity can be the 2-year-old not getting what it wants, or the 50-year-old not getting what it wants. But it does vary. And this one was if I looked at it, it was very kind of primal, and it was coming from the 2-year-old of fear, abandonment, unsafe. And it didn't affect what I was saying, but it made me contract and kind of fold a little bit. It was just an interesting thing to, and I hadn't been able to see that dynamic in the past of, I'm sort of communicating at a certain level, sort of sophisticated adult, but registering something at a different level.
So the communication was happening at the level of kind of, it wasn't the kicking and screaming kind of
not
thing.
At all.
But you were you were feeling that.
There was a twinge.
Yeah.
It was like poked.
Yeah, that's great to see that. And so it sounded like the adult was there too.
Thankfully. But the interesting thing is, so I look at the 2-year-old thing, and I was looking at it, and so my normal response would be, oh, grow up. But that's not what you'd say to a 2-year-old. You know, a 2-year-old would go, what do you mean? A 2-year-old needs what a 2-year-old needs. Understanding, nurturing, support, whatever. But I'm not quite sure what to do with this notion of 2-year-old. I mean, it's an artifice in a way, for a vestige from something in the past, or, you know, I could psychoanalyze it a bit. But
I think first just feel the 2-year-old.
Oh, yeah, feel, yeah. See. Yeah,
yeah, and accept the 2-year-old.
Right, well, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, I don't think there's much to do. I think your recognition of, oh, grow up, you know, that's not so helpful. You know,
I've been looking at the notion of compassion and self-compassion. How does one have compassion for others if one doesn't have one for oneself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have that lingua franca kind of in your fingers.
So acceptance is kind of a allowing, another word perhaps. Sometimes acceptance can be a funny word for people. For me, the word acceptance had the flavor of, I have to like this thing. You know, I have to figure out how to like this thing in order to accept it. And that's not really what it's pointing to. It's much more pointing to an allowing of this thing. You don't have to like it or not like it. It's just there. Allowing it to be as it is and see what happens to it.
Yeah, I'm curious how something like that unfolds. I mean, we all have a 2-year-old somewhere in us that hasn't been unless you've had great parents in an amazing childhood, you're all got two-year-olds that are kind of kicking and screaming, how it either, does it mature, does it fall away, get dissolved?
By the way I experience it is just that it appears sometimes. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not there. It's not like that two-year-old is a thing that has to grow up. Well, it's an arising that happens in a moment. It appears, it disappears. When it's not there, it's not there.
The construct of the two-year-old took another year to get to be a three-year-old, so it could be a construct of a three-year-old. It took another year, and then another year. And then here we are at 50. So every year there's been a causal, cause and effect, patterns of being, development, and growing from. That's had a gestation. And many of our, not many, but some, have been truncated because, you know, for whatever reasons, cause and condition. So it
but you're speaking about these things as if they exist. Well, they're simply processes.
Processes don't exist.
Processes are not an existing thing.
Well, it's a routine. It's a routine that's run. The process I'm feeling is going to be different from the two-year-old I have is different from the two-year-old you have. So there's a uniqueness from the cause and conditions that create that. And there's a uniqueness of the cause and conditions that will move away from that.
There's a process on this side of the room and there's a process on that side of the room. They're different. They're not going to get confused.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm trying to point to, and it could be totally erroneous, is that the thing that was created that arises.
That arising two-year-old?
Yeah, a vestige. The arising two-year-old, that's right. The vestige, and I would say it would be a vestige from past, whatever.
Past doesn't exist.
Well, there, it informs.
What
it informs,
what happens,
does it not?
It, the conditions come into the moment.
Right.
And in a moment, they come in, they seem to come in through memory. So memory arises. And in the memory arising, it's like there's an arising of the two-year-old.
I guess you could call it memory. I mean, there isn't a... There's a type of cognizing, but it's more of an emotional...
Yes,
it's more of a reactionary...
It can be a
reactionary kind of a...
Primal... Pre-verbal. It can be a pre-verbal kind of memory.
That's what I'm pointing to.
Yeah, it can be a pre-verbal kind of memory, yeah.
And so it's... So anyway, it's a bit of a conundrum, not a conundrum, but it's like, this is interesting. It's coming from some place that doesn't exist, absolutely, that arises, but it informs the current situation and colors it in a certain way.
It arises in this now in a certain way. Mm. I would just look at the presence, the absence of these senses of self, as opposed to having the sense of, you know, this sense of self that's arising right now has to evolve somehow, has to grow up somehow.
I hope it doesn't. I don't have, you know, years for it to grow up. I want it to go away.
Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's absent. Notice its presence, notice its absence. That's actually a really powerful exploration in daily life. Whatever it is that you're working with, you know, if you have a pattern, any habit that's pervasive, if you have a popping up two-year-old that comes a lot, you know, notice when it's there, notice when it's not there. Notice when anger is present, notice when it's absent. Noticing the absence of something is one of the more powerful ways to poke holes in the sense of the... thingness of something.
The solidity.
Yeah. And we need to stop. So, thank you.